march of time. On a thousand fronts, the history of the world moves swiftly forward. A thousand new facts, new details in the world's history come into being every hour. There is one complete record of this swift-changing civilization.
It is Time, the weekly news magazine.
Time makes it possible for the busy man to read the story of his lifetime as he lives the story of his life. Discover Time. It's on every newsstand. The new issue is out today. It's the magazine with the red border.
And now, the march of time on the screen. The second issue is now showing in 1,000 U.S. theaters. If you've not seen it, watch your newspapers for your local announcement. You will find the march of time a new experience in the motion picture theater, presenting in word and picture the whole story. The hidden beginnings, the play-by-play developments, the dramatic climaxes of the world's news events.
Tonight, the editors of Time raise the curtain again on their new kind of reporting of the news, the reenacting of memorable scenes from the news of the week, from the March of Time.
England must realize that only Germany stands between Europe and Soviet Russia. Germany must have an army of 1 million men to prevent the Red Forces of the Soviet from spreading Bolshevism and the revolution through Europe.
Receiving this blunt declaration by rearming Germany as his farewell, Captain Anthony Eden, Great Britain's brilliant young Lord Privy Seal and touring Minister of Peace, leaves Berlin for Moscow, where this week Soviet Foreign Commissar Maxim M. Litvinov welcomes him at a great diplomatic dinner, proposes a toast.
I lift my glass to the health of His Majesty, the King of England, and to the prosperity and happiness of the British people.
Thus, for the first time in Soviet history, a member of the communistic Soviet government on Soviet soil drinks the health of George V, imperialistic king of the capitalistic Great Britain, as the Soviet band plays God Save the King. Next day, as the world watches closely to see how closely England will cooperate with Russia, archenemy of capitalism, Commissar Litvinov takes Captain Eden to the somber Kremlin, presents him to Joseph Stalin. This week, the world learns what happened behind those locked doors. Russia's swarthy, hulking dictator, as always, opening the discussion with the shrewd courtesy of a question.
Tell me, Captain Eden, what is your opinion of Adolf Hitler?
My conference with Herr Hitler in Berlin convinced me of his sincerity, Mr. Stalin. I believe he believed what he said to me. But I do not feel that Herr Hitler is either reasonable or open to reason.
Captain Eden's talk with Herr Hitler has shown that Europe's danger spots are at last located and clearly defined.
What do you think is the danger of war today as compared with 1914?
I believe the danger is definitely less now than it was then.
I hope you are right, Captain Eden. But I fear I cannot agree with you. In my opinion, the danger today is much greater. In 1914, there was only one nation whose ambition to expand created war. In 1935, there are two such nations, one in Europe, the other in the Far East, Germany and Japan.
And Russia lies between them.
Captain Eden, Germany is in a highly dangerous state of mind. We must take precautions.
Precautions? Yes. But first and most important is the peace of Europe. My government stands against any policy of surrounding Germany with a ring of hostile powers.
What then does England propose, Captain Eden?
A new all-European security pact in which any nation which breaks over her boundaries as an aggressor shall be punished by all others. Germany shall have the same opportunity as any other nation to sign the pact.
There, in that map on the wall, Captain Eden, Europe, your British Isles, they are small in size. Yet today you hold the destinies of peace or war. You have the power to say whether or not ambitious schemes of conquest shall be checked.
Mr. Stalin, from Moscow I go to Poland, to Warsaw, and to Stresa, where Italy, France, and England will confer. Am I to say to the other powers of Europe that Russia favors an openly united front against Germany, or a general security pact to include Germany?
Captain Eden, Russia will join England in the General Security Pact to include Germany.
Thus, for the first time since the fall of Tsar Nicholas, Russia and England are in accord on European policy. As dapper, youthful British diplomat Eden boards his train for Warsaw, a Bolshevik military band plays the Internationale and God Save the King. Then, with characteristic Russian humor, a selection that typifies the USSR's attitude toward rearmed Germany. With the Big Bad Wolf as his send-off from Moscow, peacemaker Eden proceeds to Poland, whose leaders, fearing Germany more than they fear Russia, refuse to commit themselves to the Eden peace plan. Captain Eden returns to London for final conferences before proceeding next week to Stresa for the climax of the desperate new European peace roundup. And this week from Italy's Benito Mussolini comes his forecast on the Stresa conference.
Stresa will be a fixed point in European post-war politics. The end of the dangerous utopias of disarmament. The conference may establish between England, France, and Italy a common line of action in the face of such eventualities as warfare. But many people believe that from Stresa will come the salvation of humanity, a miracle to end the nightmare. Do not be deceived. Stresa will not be a millennium.
Time marches on. San Jose, California. In the courtroom where David Lamson is on trial for murdering his wife, a crucial question arises one day this week. The walls of the bathroom where Mrs. Lamson died were spattered with blood. Could the blood spurt 6 or 8 feet when, as the husband claims, she had cut the back of her head in falling on the edge of the tub? Or, as the prosecution contends, did the blood get on the walls as Mr. Lamson repeatedly struck the back of his wife's head with an iron pipe? Climax of this sixth week of Lamson's second trial comes when Dr. Clement H. Arnold, San Francisco physician whose hobby is murder evidence, is called to the witness stand by the prosecution.
Dr. Arnold, will you outline in your own words the test which you made and their results?
Certainly. So far as I know, no one has ever made any real experiments to discover the distance which human blood will spurt of its own force from a severed artery. So I decided to find out for myself. I first had the back of my neck shaved. Then, to raise my blood pressure, I ate a large meal, drank many cups of coffee, and smoked several cigarettes. Finally, I went with a professional photographer to the office of a friend, a surgeon, and prevailed upon him to make that.
Well, Dr. Arnold, you're sure you want to go through with this? I'm ready to inject the anesthetic.
Go right ahead. You better get your camera ready, Hardiker.
It's about set now.
How's my blood pressure, Doctor?
Still well above normal.
All right. Just follow my directions.
Wheel the surgical tray over here, Miss Thompson. Spread out that oilcloth behind the chair.
Yes, Doctor.
I'm ready, Dr. Arnold.
Now, first make a lateral, horizontal incision in the back of my neck, about 1.5 inches long, over the occipital artery.
Right. Large scalpel nurse.
And lay bare the occipital artery.
Gauze, please. All right.
Put a clamp on the artery.
Clamp, nurse.
And sever the artery.
Small scalpel, please. All right, Dr. Arnold.
Ready to take your pictures, Hardiker?
All set, Doctor.
Start your camera. Now, release the clamp. Hold back the edges of the flesh and let the blood spurt free. Try it in all directions. Compress the end of the artery. Now let the flesh close and allow the blood to flow free a moment. Got those pictures, Hardiker?
Yes.
All right. That's all.
Your Honor, comes of Dr. Arnold's test and evidence. Proceed with your testimony, please, Doctor.
It is thus proven that the blood from this artery, under any conditions, would not spurt more than 6 inches vertically or 18 inches laterally. And in a normal cut, where the edges of the wound do not gape, the blood would well out rather than spurt.
Then do you believe the stains on the bathroom wall could have come merely from the wound caused by Mrs. Lamson's falling against the tub, as the defense contends?
That is impossible.
Thus, by boldly experimenting upon his own person, Dr. Arnold throws a bombshell into the defense counsel's case in the long drawn out Lamson trial, furnishes important data for future criminal prosecution. Time marches on. Berkeley, California.
Choose to act as hostess at the annual alumni dinner of the University of California, because Francis Perkins, Secretary of Labor, has been invited here as Charter Day Speaker. The world is not so barren of persons warranting recognition that it should be necessary to choose this mere politician as the first woman to be so recognized for the university.
These tart words of Miss Martha Yams, University of California graduate, are promptly quoted by newswomen to Mrs. Franklin Delano Roosevelt in a White House press conference. Retorts Mrs. Roosevelt,
"A snub is the effort of a person who feels superior to make someone else feel inferior. To do this, it is necessary first to find someone who could be made to feel inferior. If any snub was intended, it must have been meant not for Miss Perkins, but for the people who extended the invitation."
In reply to Mrs. Roosevelt, Miss Youngs.
"I have nothing but contempt for Mrs. Roosevelt. Why should I answer her? Nothing she ever says is worth answering. I have yet to read of her saying anything on any subject in which she is manifestly versed. Mrs. Roosevelt is of the obvious type of headline seeker. Her position, of course, ensures that when she says startling things about matters of which she is ignorant, she stirs attention. That is her purpose. Mrs. Roosevelt would do well to remember that the people did not elect her president."
Caught between alumni Yams and First Lady Roosevelt, University of California's president, Robert Garden Sproul, pronounces,
"We are misrepresented by ill-advised zealots who lack balance wheels, and by one or two alumni who are so unbelievably boorish as to insult publicly a guest of the university in mere pride of personal opinion."
Miss Yams in reply.
"President Sproul's statement deserves only contempt. Thousands of alumni have no respect for President Sproul for playing politics with the Perkins woman."
And final speaker in the debate, Mrs. Yams of Berkeley, mother of Miss Yams.
"I think that my daughter and all concerned would do well to keep their mouths shut."
As the debate ends, the university holds its Charter Day exercises in the huge outdoor Greek amphitheater. There are two who do not hear Madam Secretary Perkins' speech, Miss Yams, who stays away, and ex-president Herbert Hoover, who goes but dozes throughout the speech. Time marches on. Scottsboro, Alabama. Through four bitterly controversial years to a climactic decision this week goes a case which began in the crowded, stuffy Scottsboro courtroom in April of 1931.
"My name is Virginia Price, Your Honor. On Wednesday, March 25th, I jumped a freight train at Chattanooga with my girlfriend, Ruby Bates. There were some white boys in one end of the car. Then these nine Negroes climbed into the car. They threw the white boys off the train. One of the Negroes picked me up in his arms and flung me back in the gondola. I struggled and hollered and screamed. They put their hands over my face and held a knife to my throat.
You are not trying whether or not these defendants are white or black. I don't want a verdict based on racial prejudice. But on the evidence, gentlemen of the jury, there can be but one verdict.
Find the nine defendants guilty as charged and fix the punishment of death in the electric chair.
With the Alabama court's conviction of the nine Negro boys, the Scottsboro case is appealed to higher courts on the grounds that the Negroes did not receive a fair trial. From a sordid little jury case, it swiftly becomes a nationwide issue. Then from Ruby Bates, one of the two girls involved, comes new testimony.
"Virginia Price put me up to saying what I did. The whole thing was a frame-up. What really happened is the railroad detectives took us off a freight train and brought us to the jail.
There's a big mob outside the jail. Virginia and I could hear them yelling and shouting like wild.
Virginia, what's going to happen to her? I'm scared.
Don't worry, honey. Just do like I tell you and everything will be all right.
What have I got to say?
Just tell him you was attacked by those Negroes on the train.
That's a lie.
I can't say that.
You gotta. If you don't, they'll give you a long sentence in jail for vagrancy.
They're bringing the colored boys up here.
Don't you forget what I told you.
Get in there, you. Hurry up.
Don't hit me no more, boss. Please don't hit me no more.
Now, Virginia, are these the Negroes that attacked you?
Yes, sir, Sheriff. They're the ones that done it.
We never seen these gals on a train, boss. Honestly, we never saw them.
Keep your mouth shut. Now, Ruby, you was on that freight train, wasn't you?
Yes, I was.
And did you see these Negroes?
Yes, I did.
Can you pick out the exact ones that done it?
I don't know.
Ruby.
Wasn't it these boys?
Yes.
That's better. Now, are you boys going to tell the truth?
We ain't going to talk no we need to
do. You want me to give you to that mob out there?
Yes, sir, boss. No. Please don't do that. Please.
Then will you tell the truth?
It will tell. Wait on it.
With Ruby Bates thus directly refuting the testimony of Virginia Price, public opinion flares up anew, sharply divides North and South. Violently partisan books, plays, and articles appear as the case drags through appeal after appeal. The U.S. Supreme Court rules that the Scottsboro boys did not have proper defense lawyers. They are retried and again sentenced to death. Then once more the case comes before the United States Supreme Court, this time on a fundamental issue which affects all Southern justice, the issue of Negroes serving on juries. Manhattan criminal lawyer Samuel S. Leibovitz presents the new evidence before Justice Charles Evans Hughes and his eight associates.
Your Honors, I hold up before you these books containing the grand jury rolls for Jackson County at the time of the trial of the defendant. Names of Negroes appear on the jury roll, but I can prove that the names were added after the defendants had been indicted by a grand jury made up exclusively of whites. Why were these books tampered with? The motive was to make absolutely certain that those colored boys died in the electric chair. There is no question but what these names are forgeries.
Page boy.
Yes, sir?
Bring that jury book up here to the bench and pass me my reading glass.
Yes, sir. Yours.
Look at this, Justice Vanderbilt.
Mr. Knight.
Yes, Your Honor?
You're the Attorney General of Jackson County, Alabama. Can you tell me that these names are not forged and that these jury rolls have not been tampered with?
Why, I don't know, Your Honor. I can't answer yes or no. But even if they have been, the jury commission in Alabama has the supreme power to decide who's to serve on a jury.
Not under the laws of the United States, Mr. Knight.
This week, the U.S. Supreme Court renders its decision.
Whenever all persons of the African race are excluded, solely because of their race or color, from serving as grand jurors in the criminal prosecution of a person of the African race, the equal protection of the laws is denied to him, contrary to the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. This court, therefore, reverses the judgment of conviction in the cases of these Negro boys.
Thus, this week, the Scottsboro death sentences are overturned. But its essential problem, the South's most vexing social question, is no nearer final solution. In the current book, Stars Fell on Alabama, Carl Carmer, reporting the insoluble dilemma of the South, quotes an intelligent Southerner's comment on the Scottsboro case.
I might have been for acquitting those Scottsboro Negro boys at the first trial. But now all this stink's been raised, we've got to hang them. That probably shocks you a bit. But listen to this. A few months ago, three girls I knew were driving down the mountain near the Birmingham Country Club. A Negro with a shotgun steps out of the bushes and holds them prisoner while he talks to them about how white folks oppress the colored people. When it begins to get dark, he shoots all three of them. Two of them dead. Now, that wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for this Scottsboro business, and I'm foreseeing that it doesn't happen again. I'll admit to you I'm snob enough not to have cared much about whether these Scottsboro boys were guilty or not. Those white wenches in that boxcar didn't mean a thing to me. But when it's a girl I know, one I have danced with and played tennis with, I'll be the first to put my hand on the rope. It's a hell of a mess, and I'm mighty sorry for those Scottsboro boys. But they've got to burn in the electric chair.
Alabama's prosecutor Knight states he will immediately begin a new trial of the Scottsboro Negroes. But the nation wonders what he can do to break the fundamental deadlock between the U.S. Constitution and the traditions of the Old South. A Negro has never served on an Alabama jury. If Alabama continues to exclude Negroes, the Scottsboro convictions and any convictions involving colored defendants are certain to be reversed immediately by a higher court. If Negroes do serve and vote for their own race, it means endless hung juries and no decision. Observers fear that with strict enforcement of the Supreme Court's ruling of this week, Southern court justice will be hopelessly deadlocked, and old Southern mob justice will take its place with the grisly wake of lynching, burning, and terrorism in the Southern states. Time marches on. New York City, on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House.
Deep in the shadow of his box sits one man who does not laugh with the glittering crowd. Last night of the Metropolitan's 1935 opera season, and the yearly burlesque he has seen on so many last nights before. But for him, this is the last night of last night. His quiet, bearded old Giulio Gattica-Zappa, who after 27 years as manager of the Metropolitan Opera, this year retires. With a grave smile, he watches tiny soprano Lily Pond, an acrobatic act with huge tenor Lawrence Melchior. Here's Lawrence Tibbett inside the Siegfried Dragon recite nonsense words. Then, to end the performance, comes a serious note. On the stage screen appears a moving picture, the only one ever taken in the Metropolitan. The March of Time's portrayal of Gatti in his office and backstage on his opening night this season. The audience watches the old impresario on the screen, pensively listening to the so familiar music. Sadly, reminiscently shuffling through old photographs of his opera's great singers through 27 years. Pensive now in his dark box, as he watches the picture end, Gatti hears the orchestra strike up. Hears the audience standing all together bid him final farewell.
Sad to go. I have been here a long time. 27 years. 27 good years. Geraldine Farrar. She was one of the greatest. There was something about her. something communicative and exciting. And Caruso, a personality simple and magnetic. Of music, today we need a Verdi, a Wagner. A Wagner, that is asking too much, perhaps. But to one must pray. This seeking perfection is a hard thing. I am, yes, tired and old now. I shall spend the rest of my life in Italy, high on the hill above my Lake Maggiore, listening to the songs of my Italian blackbirds.
Time marches on. You have just listened to The March of Time, the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week, presented to you by the editors of Time, the weekly news magazine. Latest news on the thrilling new venture of the editors of Time.
The March of Time on the screen. The reception of The March of Time by the American theater-going public in the past 2 months has been exciting and gratifying to us. And it has also been a challenge. The second issue now showing is better than the first. The third issue now making must and will be better than the second. Our continuing purpose, to bring to the screen not only the drama of world events, but to show you what happens, and probing deeper, tell how it happens and why.
High point of the second issue. The breaking of the biggest news story of the month, the rearmament of Germany 3 days before the story swept the front pages of the world's newspaper.
In theaters all over the country, the German sequence brought boos, hisses, and cheers and applause. For the March of Time is not ordinary moving picture entertainment. It is the picturization of men you hate or fear or admire or pity, performing their vital roles in today's history.
You can see the March of Time at the theaters of these chains throughout the country. Lowe's in New York and 40 other U.S. cities, Poli's in New England, Jay's Buffalo Theaters and the Smalley Houses of Upper New York State, the Warner Group in Philadelphia, and the Harris Amusement Company of Western Pennsylvania. In the Middle West, the March of Time is showing at the Balaban Katz chain at Chicago, the Public's Great States Theaters in Indiana and Illinois, the Burger Steffes Group in Minnesota, and the Tri-State Circuit of Iowa, Nebraska, and Illinois. The March of Time is to be seen in the Far West and the Fox West Coast and Evergreen State chains throughout Montana, California, Oregon, and Washington, the Public Salt Lake in Idaho and Utah, and the Huffman Theaters at Denver. In the South, the Sanger chain in Alabama, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Louisiana, the Kinsey Group in North and South Carolina and Virginia, the Wometco Circuit in Florida, and the Interstate Theaters in Texas and New Mexico. The Canadian Famous Players Theater chain is exhibiting the March of Time coast to coast in Canada. If the March of Time is not being shown in a theater near you, how can your local theater obtain it?
No community need be without the March of Time. It is sold independently of any other product, and a fair national price policy has now been worked out for every size, city, town, and theater. Suggest to the manager of your theater that he wire collect to March of Time distributors. Address Radio City, New York. We will send him within 24 hours complete information on how he can secure this new screen feature.
Next Friday at the same hour, the editors of Time will again present the March of Time. Time marches on. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. WABC, New York.